offering our most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, we welcome you to this week's episode of Afternoon Satsang. As always, coming to you live from our studios at Prashanthi Nilayam. This is Prem, and with me is Brother Arvind. And we are here to continue our discussion on the book Conversations with Bhagwan Sri Satya Sai Baba, where Dr. Hislop, one of Swami's devotees from the United States, has documented very, very beautiful conversations that he has had the opportunity to have with Swami. And we've been going through this for the past few weeks continuously, because there is a certain coherence we didn't want to break. There's a continuity which we thought we'll go along with. And the last week around, we stopped at a point where there was a very beautiful discussion where he asks about the concepts of Advaita and Dvaita, and Swami gives a very beautiful one-sentence definition of what is that when he says that when you look at God outside and you worship Him, it is Dvaita. When you look at Him within and you adore Him as your indweller, it becomes Vishishta Dvaita. And then Swami says you go on to see only the Lord and Lord alone, and that is the state of Advaita. He says that it is a progressive step which each one reaches. And to start with, Swami was explaining about the importance of meditating on a form. I think the discussion last week was more or less on that, the importance of having a form, importance of having love towards that form, how contemplation becomes easier, how meditation becomes easier, and how that leads to the state of samadhi is what we are speaking about. So before we carry forward the discussion as it continues in the book, let's invite Arvind to join all of us. Sairam Arvind.
Sairam Prem, and as you put it, it has been a very wonderful conversation going on, and personally, there have been so many learnings for me from it, and it's amazing how, you know, as I go through the conversations, some sentences seem to stand out like pearls of wisdom and gems and diamonds, which are so, so relevant for me. And it's obvious that those are the sentences and statements that gain importance as I speak here. I mean, for me, they're important, and therefore, possibly I focus more on them. I'm sure that as each and every one goes through this conversation, there'll be different sentences and statements standing out as pearls or diamonds for them. And that is why, you know, I just felt we should reiterate the fact that listening to this satsang is only the beginning of going through the conversations with Sai. Definitely one should go through on their own as well, because when one is reading it, different parts of the book is going to attract our attention to, based on our own needs and our own spiritual progress in life. So that is a personal experience which can't be substituted by anything. And it is just our honor and privilege, dear listeners, that as we are personally experiencing the book, Bhagwan has given this opportunity to share in a global satsang. So we are doing it. We hope that it inspires you also to take up the reading of this book on your own. And when you take it up, do take it up as a medicine, like how possibly Prem and me are doing, in small doses across time, allowing it to seep through, contemplating on it, thinking about it, because so much treasure is there. Each statement is a treasure, but as I said, depending on our needs and our requirements, we will feel some statements more treasurable than the others. You know, with that introduction, we will just go to the conversation. It starts with, today's conversation, we are going to begin with Hislop asking Swami, what is the best way to form the mental image of God? This comes with the background that Swami says that Dvaita and Vishishta Dvaita are not separate stages. They are also contained in Advaita.
Swami starts that statement which Swami made, one should have a mental image of a form of God fully developed with one's mind poured into that form. From there, he is saying, what is the best way to form the mental image of God?
Yes, yeah. So Swami says, if you wish, the form you see can be taken as an image, or a photo can be taken. So this is very, very significant, again, I felt, because Swami is not only, it becomes evident that Swami is not conversing just to Hislop, but to the entire future mankind, because Swami says, if you wish, the form you see can be taken as the image. Hislop has definitely seen the form. Swami could have stopped at that. But Swami says no, or a photo also can be taken. Which I feel is a guiding light for all of us who feel that we may not be able to see the physical frame of Bhagwan. Swami is almost equating the physical frame with a photograph of the physical frame. So, yes, so we have to be thankful to the times we are born in as well. Because, you know, if it had been any other times, possibly we would have had only a painting of the avatar. We are so blessed to have photos of the avatar, and not just photos, Prem. I often think, see, we have got photos of Swami smiling, photos of Swami bubbling with joy, photos of Swami being upset, photos of Swami reprimanding. You know, such a variety that it is so easy to actually build a mental image of Swami for ourselves, you know. It's not as if, like, if you take Shirdi Baba, there are possibly 3 or 4 actual photographs of him. It becomes difficult to imagine how Shirdi Baba might be when he's scolding, how he might be when he's cajoling. But that difficulty is removed because of such a variety of photographs. And the added delight is the videos that we have, the avatars. Because even without evolving spiritually, we are able to benefit and enjoy the form as it has been captured in the photos and videos. And when Swami says this, Hislop continues, if a photo of Swami or the directly perceived image of Swami is taken as the mental image, no doubt the concentration should not waver from the chosen image, right? That is the question he asks. And Swami responds by saying, the mind should be steady on the one chosen image of God. Please say that again, Swami, Hislop asks. And Swami clarifies, the mind is poured into the mould of the image so that the mind is the image of God.
I think this is one of the most beautiful explanations Swami is giving of meditation. Now, talking about the image, before we come to that last statement, which is the most profound thing that Swami is saying, the idea of, you know, take any, the way Swami puts it, he says the form you see can be taken as an image, or even a photo can be taken as an image. So from Swami's point of view, as you rightly said, it doesn't matter whether you've physically seen Swami or you've seen him only as a photograph. But if you come to think of it, I was just thinking of this yesterday sometime. The personality of somebody like Jesus Christ, right? Today we have DNA mapping and the kind of feature rebuilding of certain races, so people from certain regions of the world in certain times. And based on that, they've built an image of what, you know, Jesus Christ would have actually looked like. From his Aramaic origins, coming from Bethlehem, being born there, a person who lived in, you know, Israel, in those regions. Clearly an image of Jesus Christ, very close to what he would have actually looked like, people from those times. And that image is so much more different from the image of Jesus Christ. Thousands and thousands of people have, I mean, for hundreds of years, people have been visualizing and been praying to. And they have had the experience. It's not like they have not been given the experience because they were visualizing a wrong image of Jesus, right? And I think that is why what Swami is telling is very important. When we think of an image, we only think of the features of the face or the structure of the body. But when you think of an image, Swami would often say this, it is the gunas which you think of. When you think of God, you think of His compassion. When you think of God, you think of His forgiving nature. You think of His, you know, endless love. And that is the real form, the mind to concentrate on. And when Swami says, the beautiful example that Swami is giving, if an image is made out of silver, the hair is silver, the eye is silver, everything, the silver fills the image. You know, the silver becomes the image. So when Swami is saying you contemplate with the mind on the form, it is like forming an image of God with the mind, which means your mind takes the form of that image. And now when you say the form, by saying form, you also mean the gunas, the attributes. You are leading your mind to take those attributes. The difference between, we were speaking about it last week, the difference between meditating on an object, you know, concentrating on a tumbler, or concentrating on a rock, concentrating on a thumb. The reason why concentrating on a name and form of God is important is your mind fills that form and takes those attributes that you so much worship. And it automatically comes to you, the righteousness, the selflessness and all of that. The mind takes that form. It's a wonderful explanation that Swami has given.
You know, I think that is precisely the reason why in his famous bhajan, Swami sings, love is my form. Because whatever form we take, even, you know, the other day I was speaking with Brother Sai Prakash, and he was telling me, he was showing me a photograph of Swami in 1994, you know, mm-hmm. and he said, you know, this is the Swami I think of, I meditate on. And when I thought of that, for me, the Swami that I think when I'm, you know, when I'm in trouble, if I want to converse or if I'm very happy and I want to share my joy with him, I close my eyes and I speak. Prem, believe me, the Swami of 2005 and 6 comes. The Swami in my mind's eye with whom I converse is on a chair always or on a wheelchair, because that is the form. Whatever people may say, you know, Swami used to walk, that is grand, glorious, and we don't want the wheelchair Swami. For me, the dearest form of Swami is the wheelchair Swami. And that has happened because possibly of my association during that period and the experiences that have built in. So even when we talk of form of Swami, you know, we carried the interview of Mrs. Shamantakamani Bhashyam. For all that, you know, the image of her Swami might be the one with a parting of the hair, because that's how Swami was in his teenage years or 20s, you know. So even when we talk of Swami himself, we have so many forms that come to the mind's eye of so many people. And for all that, you know, today when people think of Swami, they might be thinking of the Sannidhi. The photograph there in the Sannidhi with the marble structure. We don't know, but that's what it is. So even in the within the form of Swami, there are so many variants possible. It's like, you know, when the Ganesh Chaturthi festival, it's going to come in September now. When it comes, we all get idols of Ganesha. What a variety is there in color, in structure, in shape, in the face expression. So many, you know, and yet we pick. It's the same Ganesha. So like you said, the form is just an external representation which the mind can hold on to as a representative of the love, compassion, grace, grandeur and bounty that is represented by God. So really it doesn't matter, and that's what Swami clearly says, because like he says there, the mind is poured into the mold of the image and the mind is the image of God. To that Hislop says, oh, I see. That is the most enlightening. But Swami, we feel happier when in Swami's physical presence and not so happy when Swami is away. And to this Swami gives a reply which, you know, blew my mind over. Swami says, you are identified with your physical form and so you look to the form of another. When you are less attached to the physical form, your happiness will be more even. You know, I feel it is so powerful, because Swami is saying here that if you feel that Swami being physically there is more nice, is much better, is more amazing than, say, Swami in a photograph or Swami as a memory or Swami in a video or Swami through his message. You know, Swami says, my life is my message, which means my message holds my life. So Swami is there in the text of the Satya Sai Speaks, in the audio of the discourse, in the video that we see, in the photo. But if we feel that these are poor substitutes for the actual form of Swami, and let's accept it, we feel that so strongly many times. Swami says, if you're feeling that, that is because you have Dehabhimanam. You are having body attachment. And Swami says, if you overcome your body attachment, then you will get the same joy that you're getting when you see the form of the Lord, when you're seeing the photograph, when you're seeing the idol, or when you hear the words of the Lord. And it makes a lot of sense, because when we think of the saints in India, you take the saints of Maharashtra, Eknath, Tukaram, Gajanan Maharaj, or you take the other saints, Ramadas, Mirabai, Annamaya, all these saints, if you take saints and sages who were lost in the bliss of the Lord, none of them actually ever saw the Lord. They were only in touch with the message of the Lord, or with a painting of the Lord, or with an idol of the Lord. Which means, going by what Swami has said, consciousness. They got over their ahankara, they got over that body consciousness, because of which they were able to enjoy limitless bliss. The same like as if they are seeing God in person. I feel it is so beautiful, because it puts the ball back in our court. It's in our effort now. How much I am able to shave away this body consciousness, remove away this Dehabhimanam, to that extent I'll be able to enjoy the bliss of seeing Bhagwan in the physical, even when I'm just seeing a photograph, an idol, or reading the words that he has spoken in a Satya Sai Speaks.
What Nishlap is saying here is something which a lot of people come and ask us, especially those of us who have had this opportunity to stay physically close to Swami. I think the other day there was a devotee who had attended the workshop by our Prashanti Mandir Bhajan group. And this devotee was telling me that, you know, she was feeling that here is a group which was so close to Swami physically, which depended so much on Swami's physical presence. You know, some of the experiences they were narrating that Swami said, you know, I didn't like this. So Swami corrected them during a bhajan. Swami would control the talam of the bhajan. And these are all things that we have seen. And if you look at it, physically Swami was in so much command and control over what was happening in that bhajan hall during that bhajan session. And, you know, she was saying that I could feel how enormously they must be missing Swami now in a session like that, right? And it is so true. A lot of people come and ask, you know, how did you manage that physical absence? And sometimes if you think of it, in a way, we thought we depended so much more on the physical form as, more than we even realized. Or I don't know whether I've said it right. We gave it too much more importance than it actually meant in our mind. A lot of times in Prashanti Nilayam now, it has happened so many times, you have to remind yourself of Swami's absence. It's the other way around. It's not that you have to remind yourself of Swami's presence always. In fact, that you feel all the time, you have to, sometimes you remember, oh, Swami is not here physically. Because everything else is so much like Swami is around. Because when you're thinking of Swami, when you're doing Swami's work, you always feel that, you know, Swami's presence is there. In that sense, you know, when you've lived with Swami for so long, when you've got attached to that physical form, when you've made important decisions in your life based on Swami's physical presence, where is he? Where is he going to stay more? A lot of people who relocated to India because they felt they could live closer to Swami. Many of these people, they're the, you know, like what Hislop is saying, that Swami, once we have felt that enormous influence of the physical form, now we find it very, very difficult to think that. And the answer which Swami is giving is so profound. He's saying, the difference is in your mind, right? The other day when I was talking to some devotees, I was telling that, see, this is what Swami has said, that if you want me, I'm there. If you want to be guided by me, I'm there to guide you every step. As Swami would say, you know, Sambhavami Pade Pade. It's not that I'll come once in a lifetime, but I'll come at every step that you need me. Right? And I was saying that, see, this is a statement that Swami has made physically, but in Swami's mind, if you could use that phrase, in Swami's mind, there is no limitation of the physical. In us listening to that, the limitation is there in our mind. The Swami said it when he was in his physical form. Does it apply even now? From Swami's point of view, there is no difference, because what Swami is saying is true in all times, now and forever. So the limitation is always in our mind. And once I was thinking of this, you know, Swami makes this statement, you go from Salokyam to Samipyam to Samipyam to Sarupyam and Sarupyam to Sayujyam. Where Swami would say Salokyam is when you simply put, acknowledge the presence of divinity, right? In your affairs in life, you pray to God. You know, there is a person who's taking care of you. You kind of give a small space for God in your life. And Samipyam is when you start striving to get close to Swami, even in the physical sense. You know, I think it made more sense to us when we wanted to physically go close to Swami, we wanted to catch Swami's attention. And then Swami says from Samipyam to Sarupyam, and that's a very subtle point where Swami says you start taking on the form of the Lord that you worship. And when I was thinking of that, the understanding which I came, of course, now reading these words, it feels that Swami is exactly saying the same thing. You know, the thought I got was, see, in this journey of you trying to become closer to Swami, or you trying to please Swami with your actions, in the spiritual level, what is going to happen is, you're going to understand who you are in a more true sense. So when you say Sarupyam, your idea of what your form is going to undergo a change. From thinking that I'm only this body, I am going to grow in that belief who I really am. And as my understanding of who I am changes, my understanding of who Swami is also will improve. And that is how these two understandings come close. When Swami says Sarupyam, it is not the physical change, but it's what you associate yourself to be. That changes, and what you associate Swami to be also will change. And when it comes close enough, Swami says it will happen, Sayujyam will take place. Which literally means, it is like when you get the bullock and the cart close enough, you can yoke one over the other. Yuj means to yoke.
And it becomes one vehicle.
It becomes one entity. It is no more two. So it's that's precisely what Swami is saying, that when your idea of who you are changes, when you give up your body consciousness, when you understand that you're not just this body, you will also see that Swami is also not that. How can Swami be that when you yourself are not just the body? Right? It's a wonderful explanation that Swami is giving here.
And I think when you say sarupyam, rupa means form. And again, if we go back to the same song where Swami says, love is my form. So when we say sarupyam, it's not like I start resembling Swami, but my love starts resembling Swami's love.
Right. My attributes.
I become what Swami says as expansion love. Expansion love. And, you know, I was thinking in a practical way also, if we look at this, if I truly am less attached to my physical, means if I stop defining myself by my body and my mind, if I start expanding a little bit more, say to grow from me and myself to at least my family level, you know, then from my family level, if I can move on to what we call as the Sai brothers and sisters, you know, the Sai family that we call, which is worldwide. I think when we grow in that manner, we will, as Swami says here, when you are less attached to the physical form, your happiness will be more even. It will be more. And I think that is because, let's take the small example that we have seen happening in day-to-day life. When I sit and listen to someone narrating a beautiful incident that happened in his life, most of the time what happens is, I'm able to experience that same joy, and at times I find my eyes getting wet with tears. I find my heart bubbling with joy. How is this? I have not experienced that. I'm just listening to it. But that person's experience is becoming my own experience, because possibly for that brief period in satsang, I have been able to expand my love, wherein I'm able to experience somebody else's experience. If I'm able to maintain that state always, then Prem, it doesn't matter whether Swami had an interaction with this physical body or not, because listening to Swami's interactions with any other physical body will be giving me the same joy, because I am no longer constrained or limited by my physical body. I don't know if I'm expressing it clearly over here. But practically, that's an experience of we growing and expanding in our love, I feel. When you narrate to me your experience of how you went through trials and tribulations, and how Swami finally gave you the blessing that your heart was seeking, when you reach that point, we have seen that. If you're speaking it out, when you speak it out, why is there suddenly a rapturous applause? Because everybody is able to celebrate along with you for that point in time. I think that is a moment when we have been able to transcend our ego and feel one with the experience of the other person. So we have seen this happening. And that itself, I think, is practical proof for us to show that if we are less attached to our physical form, our happiness will definitely grow, because everybody's happiness becomes my happiness. And that somewhere, I feel, is the secret behind Swami being blissful always. Because somebody or the other in the world is going to be blissful always, and that bliss is his bliss.
Just looking at that last statement that Swami is making, you know, when you're less attached to the physical form, your happiness will be more even. I think even Professor Venkatraman has spoken about this. You know, there are, when you talk about the desires, he would say that there are desires of the body, there are desires of the mind.
Hmm.
The pleasures of the body, the pleasures of the mind.
Hmm.
Right? And the pleasures of the mind are a little more expansive compared to the pleasures of the body. And the best example you can think of that is, you know, suppose you, somebody were to give you a sweet to eat. The moment you put it in your mouth, your senses are made in such a way that you will enjoy a certain relish. And scientifically put, you know, there are certain hormones which will be secreted in your brain and you feel a sense of happiness, right? And there are many, many sweets. Let's say your favorite sweet is a gulab jamun or something like that. And if the same sweet, the physical body is going to undergo the same reaction what eating a sweet. But now, because my mind is attached to that sweet, because I see this as different from other sweets and I like it more than the others, the pleasure that I will feel eating that will be a little more than just the body pleasure.
Hmm.
In fact, so much more, even if mentioning that will make you, if I tell you that tomorrow I'm getting gulab jamuns, you'll start feeling happy from now itself.
Hmm.
Right? So that is the ability of the mind when it starts feeling pleasure. And then Swami says, imagine the pleasure which is beyond the mind. That even likes and dislikes do not become a barrier for you to enjoy or not enjoy something. As they would say, raga and dvesha. You know, you like something, and the moment you remove that idea that I don't like at all, then there is nothing which you dislike, so there is endless enjoyment. And we talk about the bliss form. That's what Swami would say. That the when you go beyond that duality of like and dislike, you go into that state where you are able to enjoy everything equally. And as you're saying, the state where Swami is, everything is only bliss, because there's nothing that is to be disliked. Everything is acceptable. Everything is enjoyable. Right? And that's what Swami says. The moment you start transcending the physical, the happiness that you will feel will be more even also, which means it does not have an up and down. It does not have any situation which can pull it down. Anything cannot come into your life which can challenge that happiness. It's going to be more even. So, a very, very beautiful progression of Swami teaching about meditating on the form and what happens when you start meditating on the form, and then the happiness that you feel. And the more you kind of unhinge it from the physical, you are giving it the opportunity to literally, it's like the kite that you let go. You know, there is no limit to the soaring of the kite.
On that note, dear listeners, we'll take a quick little break. And on the other side of the break, we'll continue with what Swami is speaking about, how he works. It is very, very interesting, and it also gives us an insight into Swami's day-to-day routine and activities. All those interesting things coming up right after this little break.
Tu mahi amare mata pita sa.
Welcome back, dear listeners. After that beautiful rendering of the Nirakari Allah, it's I don't know what to say. It's fantastic. It's paradoxical. We are speaking about the form, and the song is about the formless. The next question that Hislop asks Swami is that one regards himself as a son of Swami. Swami is as the mother, and we confide in him directly. If possible, but if not, then by prayer and by writing to him. And Swami says, there is an endless flow of letters coming to Swami. Swami reads all the letters, and at about 10 a.m., the letters are burned. Swami does everything himself, so everything is done right. Swami never sleeps. At the middle of the night, he turns off the light and rests in the bed. Because if light is on, devotees gather. Swami has no need of sleep. But men need sleep, at least 4 hours of sleep. It is essential for them. People think that Baba rests in the afternoon until 4 p.m. But he never rests. He is never tired. He is always working. People are upset when 3 or 4 relatives visit. But Baba's visitors are endless. Baba is attending to every detail of his scholars and colleges. And to the millions of his devotees. And for most people, the responsibility for their work rests elsewhere. But Baba is responsible for the results as well as for the work. That, dear listeners, is in brief Swami's day by Swami himself. Very interesting points that Swami reads all the letters, and all the letters are burnt every day on a daily basis. And Swami says he never sleeps. We have heard this from some of the other brothers also who have had the privilege of living with Swami, where they say that Swami would often at late in the night or very early in the morning be in the bathroom with the light on so that the light disturbs nobody, and Swami will be either going through letters, but Swami will not be sleeping. So there is anecdotal evidence also to show that Swami barely would sleep. But the selflessness that is there, you know, that is the, I think, a practical demonstration of his love, that pure love, wherein even in that, though he is the master of the universe, he doesn't want to disturb anybody else. He wants to ensure that the devotees are well rested. So for their sake, he ensures lights are all on. You know, this is so true about devotees being on a lookout for Swami. My father used to tell me that in those days, it became a problem because people located the water pipes that were leading out of Swami's room so that they could tap into it, and that would be like Tirtham, Swami's bath water, you know. Because when in temples you do Abhishekam to an idol, that water is only consumed as Tirtham because it has gone over the idol, it is consecrated by the idol. So that is when all the plumbing got sealed within. He said that would happen, and everybody would keep looking at Swami's room. If the slightest light comes on, there's somebody there. So it would disturb all the devotees as well, because, you know, of their enthusiasm for Swami, and for their sake, Swami would do all this. You know, when we even speak to alumni, they say, those who were there in the 70s at Vrindavan, this is what it was. The whole day they'll be standing, keeping their eye on the window or door where Swami would come. So when that kind of adoration and adulation is there, for the sake of the devotees, Swami would do all this. But as he himself says, he had no need for rest, and he would always be doing things, reading letters, thinking of the devotees. And you know, when he says this, I can so easily identify with what Swami is saying. When he says that you get 4 guests at home, really, Prem, when we get 4 guests at home, it's wonderful for a day or two. But beyond 2 days, you just wonder when they're going to leave, when you can have your privacy back, when it can become peaceful again. To different extent, I'm sure everyone feels like that. You know, even though you may have a 5-bedroom home where different bed, they're not occupying your own place and you have sufficient place for all, still, it is not easy, it's uncomfortable. And what Swami is hosting is on a daily basis, thousands of people listening to their problems, it's phenomenal. Sheerly that itself shows that it is God, it's not human, it's definitely superhuman.
Sometime back we were going through the first discourse that Swami gave in Prashanthi Nilayam. We know that the first public discourse that Swami gave was in Karur. 47, right? 47
correct. Or 40, 1947. Right. Or 46 maybe.
Yeah. And this was the discourse I think Swami gave during the Dashara celebrations in Prashanthi Nilayam, probably the start of Swami giving public discourses. Mm. And in that, Swami very beautifully makes a reference to the day on which he declared and he sang Manasa Bhajare Guru Charanam. And Swami said, you know, here is me, here is the Guru calling everybody's attention to the path that will redeem them. And then Swami goes on to say that some of you bring flowers, some of you bring fruits. And these are all expressions of your devotion, and I see it. But I don't want any of this, because this excludes some devotees who are not able to show their devotion in this form. Mm. There are a lot of poor people who probably would love to do it. You know, they have the devotion to back that kind of an offering, but they don't have the resources to back that kind of an expression of their devotion. So Swami said, I'm not interested in all of that. If you look at it that way, probably Swami is the, you know, a unique phenomenon that Swami started is this accepting of letters, which I don't think anybody needs any kind of resources to do that. It is so easy to express your devotion. And Swami was once, I think, telling to some students, when the students were asking Swami, it's physically impossible for you to read all the letters. You know, you might be reading enormous number of letters, you might be reading letters all through the day, but it's not physically possible that you're reading all the letters. Right? And Swami said, I don't need to read any of the letters, I know what is written. And then Swami, I think, asked the students, when you write a letter, what is the emotion that is going through you? What is the feeling that you're going through? So he said, Swami, it feels like we are opening up everything to you. You know, we are sharing everything with you. We are offering whatever pain we have in. And Swami said, yes, that is the only true emotion. You write a letter to express that emotion. I accept that letter to honor that emotion. So very beautifully he said, you write it to express it, I accept it to honor that feeling that you have that I'm offering it to Swami. That's all is this exchange of letters, and it's really unique. I don't think any other temple we have this thing of writing a letter and placing it at the altar. And this is definitely a tradition which is going to continue. I think even now people come and offer their prayers in the form of letters in Swami's Sannidhi. And really, and the way even the discussion itself progresses, or it started off with, that's what Hislop is saying. Swami, when possible, we physically come and, you know, express our feelings to you. And even otherwise, we always find a way of writing letters to you. And here is Swami saying that I accept it. You know, sometimes Swami expresses his acceptance sometimes by physically reading that letter. But sometimes Swami says, me accepting it itself is a sign of me accepting whatever you have offered.
And I feel even in those cases, Prem, when Swami didn't accept a letter, I'm sure you, me, all of us have had those experiences. It's not that we have 100% success rate in giving letters to Swami. Even when Swami didn't accept it, we didn't stop writing, because just writing that letter itself did something to us, you know. The mere act of writing a letter to Swami was transformational in itself. And if it goes to the level of Swami accepting it, it's fantastic. It's nice. Sometimes Swami would accept it and read it in our own presence. That's more fantastic. All said and done, just writing the letter itself was so wonderful. And I must say, Prem, that even to this day, whenever I feel at my wit's end, usually it's on the negative side, when I'm feeling bad, when I'm feeling low, when I'm feeling at my wit's end, when I don't know what to do, I continue to write the letter, and I strongly wish to advocate this letter writing. It's not as if you have to be in Puttaparthi to write or post it. I'm saying this because I get many mails personally where people are asking me, can I write letters to Swami and send it to Prashanthi? Will it be put at the Sannidhi? What will happen? What happens to the letters nowadays? Honestly speaking, I also don't have a very clear idea. I just know this much, that yes, letters are offered at Sannidhi, and I assume that by the end of the day they must be getting destroyed or incinerated. But what I would like to encourage is, it doesn't matter whether I'm able to keep it in the Sannidhi or not. We all have altars in our home. We all have altars in our heart. Write the letter and offer it to Swami. Let not our physical distance from Prashanthi Nilayam be the determining factor to whether I write letter or not. I must tell you, Prem, recently, as recent as January 2019, something very interesting happened. The last year in October, there was my sister-in-law's wedding, for which a lot of family members, family had come from different parts of the world. And most of them, a large chunk of family came from the United States of America. Mm-hmm. Now, one little girl, one cousin's daughter, she became sick during that visit to India, and they went back home and try as hard as they did, they were unable to diagnose exactly what's wrong with her. So this girl must be about 10 to 13 years of age, 12 to 13 years of age, kept losing weight, had diarrhea, had nausea, and later even her liver started getting affected, and they had no clue what was going on. And, you know, the paradoxical thing is, her mother is a doctor, her uncle is a doctor, her grandfather is a doctor, and they are in Cleveland, which is home to Cleveland Clinic, one of the world's foremost medical treatment centers. In spite of all their contacts, in spite of all their whatever they did, they were just unable to diagnose what was wrong with this girl, and this girl was on a steady decline. In a matter of 2 months or something, by the end of that year, she had lost, I think, about 10 kilograms, and she had stopped going to school. The school was also very kind on her. They were telling that, no, we will send you the notes home, you can do. And they cooperated, but the parents were really worried. And on one occasion, you know, when we just happened to talk to them over WhatsApp, that time the grandmother, she said, you know, please pray to Swami, you know, pray to Swami something, don't know what's going on. They were very worried. And even I felt very sad, worried. And so, you know, I actually wrote a letter. I wrote a letter and kept it in my altar. I'm saying this just to show that it's so important that we continue with the act of writing a letter. It doesn't matter whether I'm able to send it to Puttaparthi or place it at it doesn't matter, because Swami is everywhere. So wrote it and I kept it in my own altar. And it so happens that I have a small idol of Swami. So I folded the letter and placed it under the idol. Now, because the idol is also marble in color, the paper is also that, I forgot about it, and the letter continued to stay there for many weeks. Now, fast forward 1 month later, somewhere in the January, after all the sports meet and Shankranti, I was just cleaning the altar, and when I raised this idol, I saw this letter. I suddenly remembered, I called out to my wife and said, hey, remember that letter, hey, how is she doing now? So, we thought that, yeah, we should get in touch and find out how is she doing. I took and I felt it's done now. I just wanted to throw the letter. It's done. It has served its purpose. When I opened the letter, Prem, inside the letter there was trace amounts of vibhuti. There was vibhuti that had manifested inside the letter. Mm-hmm. And both of us were so thrilled with that. And when we actually managed to get in touch with them in America, they said that the situation has not improved. She has stabilized, but still she has not regained any weight. Don't know what. They're seeing how, whether she should discontinue and lose her whole academic year. That is when we told them that, you know, we are told to write the letter, we wrote the letter, but and by Bhagwan's grace, you know, there is vibhuti in the letter. She said, send it over to us immediately. I was wondering, how do we send it over? Shall I send it by FedEx? So, no, don't. Any powder or anything that you send by mail is going to get scanned and discarded. It won't be allowed to enter United States itself, because I think they are almost paranoid about biohazards and threats and chemical weapons and all that. So I don't know, again, intuitively, I just called one of our brothers who's working in the hospital. Mm-hmm. I don't know why I felt like calling him. I just called him and asked him, brother, do you know anyone going to United States? He said, where in United States? Because United States is a very big country. I said, actually, in the state of Ohio. And then he says, you know what? I just met somebody over lunch today. He's leaving tomorrow night to Cleveland. I said, perfect, they're in Cleveland. It worked out. Magically, the vibhuti reached them within 2 days. And a week after that, they said that she's back to regaining her weight. She started going back to school again. And her liver is definitely damaged, but it's recovering, because liver happens to be the only organ in the human body which can regenerate itself. And believe it, Prem, even to this day, they still don't know what has happened. They're just happy that it's passed and they've still not got a diagnosis. You know, this was so thrilling personally. After that, you know, regularly, almost on a monthly basis, I've written letters to Swami. Not got such overwhelming response, of course. There have been no more vibhuti, nothing. But I just feel it is like those times when you know, in the letter that we have given to Swami, maybe one or two letters, we have seen Swami open in front of us and read in our presence. That gives us a thrill. But then, we would write many letters which Swami just accept, and even a larger proportional letter which Swami will not even pick. But there is so much of satisfaction, fulfillment, joy, and something magical happens when we just write a letter. Because while we are writing the letter, our thoughts, our words, our actions, all are in sync with Swami, and that is enough to get us that connect. It's so beautiful. And that's why to this day, as I said, after January, there has been no these kinds of miraculous experiences or whatever. But anytime I feel like, at least once a month, I make it a point to write a letter, keep it in the altar, maybe for 2 days, 3 days, 5 days. At the end of it, yeah, tear it and discard it. Because as Swami himself is saying here, that's what he would do. It would all be burnt. So I really wanted to stress and emphasize that this is a beautiful sadhana. As you rightly said, it's very unique to this avatar. And since it is such a special one, let us utilize it. Swami has encouraged it all his life. He started doing it from as early as the 50s till as late as 2011. Swami has accepted letters. In fact, even 2 days before he went to the hospital, one of the final public acts that Swami did was to collect more than 50 to 60 letters from all the students who were seated right in the front. It was amazing. I know it because I was sitting there and taking photographs. Every student, before it would be that Swami would look and indicate with his eyes or finger and tell come, and he would take letters from the students. But on that day, students were just getting courage out of nowhere, getting up and walking. And Swami was also not protesting. He was just welcoming whoever came and gave him letters. I am sure that is the divine prodding from within, because of which they got the courage. Otherwise, we know how in Swami's presence, nobody dares to do such indiscipline where you get up and just walk to Swami. But on that day, possibly, I think, I'm convinced that that's a very powerful message that Swami gave, that the final public act that was done in Kulwant Hall was accepting, I think, about 70 to 80 letters. So we should continue. It's a beautiful sadhana. I'm sure we all will get our own special experiences as we do it.
You know, one of the old students was narrating about his experience of writing letters to Swami in initial years. Mm-hmm. And he was saying of one incident where Swami was coming back into Vrindavan. I think Swami was coming from Prashant Nilayam or something. And we used to line up waiting for Swami's car to come, right? So like that, the students were standing. And this boy was trying to get into the line. You know, he was trying to squeeze in. And the boy in front was not giving him space. He said, no, I want to stand in front. There's a little bit of tussle by which they literally elbowed each other in, you know. And as that little scuffle was going on, Swami's car entered. And they noticed that Swami was seeing them, that this little bit of shouldering and pushing which was happening. But then they immediately became quiet. And Swami went in. And later Swami came and asked, what happened? What were both of you talking? Swami said, no, Swami, nothing was happening between us. And you're saying, see, here is Swami. He has already shown us so many times that he knows everything. And he's coming and asking us, and we're still trying to, you know, hide from him. Mm-hmm. Said, you know, this is the level in which our Maya is. But then, you know, Swami is saying that, no, I know what happened. And Swami explained that you both were fighting like this. So he said that he went back, and whole night he was feeling very bad. One thing was fighting like this. And the other thing is, when Swami came and asked, in front of Swami, you're telling a lie, knowing mm-hmm. very well that Swami knows everything. So he said, I wanted to write a letter to Swami. So it was late into the night. And he could not find a letter pad in which he could write. So he went from room to room, and as fate would have it, the boy with whom he had a fight, he was the only fellow who was awake. So he had to go and borrow a paper from him and then write this letter. And in that he had written, sorry Swami, and this is what I did. And I also tried to cover it up when you came and told me, and the whole thing is written. And he's standing. And then Swami comes and asks him, what happened? What is that letter? So he got up to say, and then Swami started telling the whole thing what happened last night. And Swami said, oh, then you didn't find paper, then you went to his room and he had the paper you took from him, and this is what you've written. And he's like, he's looking at the paper and he's looking at Swami. He said, why do we do this? Why do we write at all? Right? But, and Swami was like giving the whole contents of the letter. And he was saying another occasion when something very similar happens. And in Trai Vrindavan, suddenly Swami said, anybody wants to talk? And many number of students were getting a chance to speak during that particular trip. So he said, let me also speak something. And I know I'm not a speaker, but at least it'll go down in my diary as I've spoken in Swami's presence once, mm-hmm. right? And he said, Lord, let's lift our hand. And he lifted his hand and Swami said, now you'll speak, come and speak. And he said he made a fool of himself. And one particular statement he says is he mentioned in Swami's presence, Swami says that the same Gopikas and the monkeys of the Dwapara Yuga, Treta Yuga have been reborn as Swami's students and all. And Swami stopped him. And Swami said, have you ever heard me say that?
Oh, okay.
He said, no, Swami. Then why are you saying that? I've never made that statement. Swami said, something you speak. Okay, continue. Let him finish the talk. Huh. He said, again, he felt very bad. He went back and again he sat in the night and he wrote the letter. Hmm. And he said, Swami, he wrote these very words. He said, Swami, I spoke some nonsense, all mad things I spoke. Please forgive me and I'll never speak like this henceforth. I'll be very careful of what I speak. And the same thing happened the next day. Swami comes to him and Swami kind of gives a, point by point narration of what is there in the letter. This is what you have said and all that. And Swami just playfully hit him on the head and he went away. Of course, he was saying that I told Swami in that, almost like a promise I gave Swami in that letter. Swami, henceforth I will never speak meaningless words. Hmm. I'll never speak stupid things like this. And he said, today I am a personality trainer. He said, I go to corporate houses and I give presentations of how you have to carry yourself, how you have to speak. He said, not once have I got this remark that you spoke nonsense, even as a casual. So he says that one statement that I wrote in the letter, Swami, henceforth I will never speak nonsense. Swami has ensured that I never speak nonsense hereafter. He said he did not take the letter from me that day, but he too accepted the prayer and he has given me the blessing. And I think, as you were saying, that sense of satisfaction that we get that we've offered it to him is something which is incredible. It's indescribable in words, the opportunity that Swami gave us.
And the connect that comes, it's like, the observer effect, where we say that by the mere act of observing itself, we are influencing the whole situation. It's almost like that.
Absolutely.
By the mere act of writing the letter, we are influencing the connect with him, and in the positive way. That has been my experience, and I'm sure that will be the experience of anyone who attempts this, because it is Swami's promise. It is what Swami has encouraged during his entire sojourn on earth. After that, where Swami says that for most people the responsibility of their work rests elsewhere, but Baba is responsible for the results as well as for the work. So it is, I think this whole stanza, para, Swami is also highlighting the statement of hands in society, head in the forest. It doesn't mean that just because you are spiritual, you do away with your worldly activities and say this is worldly and you separate it. No. Swami, even if we look from a worldly angle, has slogged, has struggled, worked day in and night, toiled tirelessly, he has done everything. So, that it is, as Swami is saying this, Hislop interjects by saying, Baba is responsible also for his other worlds, is he not? And Swami says, yes. For saints, rishis and yogis everywhere, Swami is attending to the guidance, protection and welfare of these, wherever they may be. And Hislop again says, I mean, Swami is responsible for the entire universe, not just this world, right? And Swami says, it's like this. Baba is the switch. The switch is turned on and all goes forward automatically. As the key is turned in a car, all parts of the car work automatically. In a similar way, the universe is automatically regulated. The so-called miracles are not miracles, nor do they prove divinity. Baba's endless work in all the worlds, easy, no wait, always happy, that is the miracle.
Right. And there are two important things, concepts as such, if you look at it.
Mm-hmm.
That one statement that Swami made before this Hislop's remark, he said, Baba is responsible for results as well as the work.
Hmm.
I think a very, very profound statement that Swami is making. Because as people who have to do our duty, Swami would say that your responsibility lies only in the work. You have to do what you have to do. The results will come to you. The results are not, it can neither be controlled by you nor is it anything of your interest. It will come to you when you have done the result properly. Here Swami is saying, I am both departments. When I come as an avatar, I have to do the work, but that doesn't take the responsibility of the results away from me. The results are still in my, and that's what Swami says, for most people, the work is in one place, but the responsibility is elsewhere. But when the avatar comes, he also does the work, and he also ensures that the right results come for that particular work. You know, when Swami takes up a project, or when Swami builds something, or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
And that statement, and the other one where Swami is talking about, this beautiful analogy of the switch which is turned on. It's a typical misconception that we always have, you know, when we talk about divine will, and Swami says nothing happens without divine will, nothing happens without, even a blade of grass does not move without God's will. We think of God's will as a choosing will at that time, that, you know, God chooses to do this or chooses to do that. That's what when we say, I will to do this, or I will do this, or whatever it is. But when Swami talks about the divine will, Swami is talking about something like the electricity without which nothing will function. Right? That's why he's saying the moment the car is turned on, all the other functions of the car will work automatically. It is not that the driver who's sitting there has to go and ensure that the brake works, the clutch works separately, the ignition works separately. It's just that one act which has to be done. The rest of it is made in such a way that once it gets the trigger, it goes on. So Swami is saying that divine will, if God wills everything, why is he willing that children should suffer in malnutrition, or why should people die in calamities and such things like that?
The thought that is occurring to me now is like, you know, the domino effect. Actually, if you go to any particular section of the domino, and we can just find videos of domino effects online, you know, where they make huge dominoes extending over sometimes even meters and up to a kilometer of area, you know, dominoes. And all that you do is you start the first one, just tap it, and then the whole thing, there's a domino effect.
Right.
There's another kind of domino videos also that you see where it's not about just this, but you know, you a ball goes and rolls and hits, and then a bead goes on, then a switch is put on, then water falls.
It's called the Rube Goldberg machine.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, multiple
kind of, yeah. So, I think it is like that, you know, when we say God's will, it might be just that little thing. When Swami says it, like putting on the switch, it might be just as small as tapping a ball or pushing a ball bearing. That doesn't mean God is not in control, because who created that entire system? You know, it's like that. If you want to take another example, I feel it's like a software coder coding a program. After all that, when you just give an input, immediately the output comes. But that doesn't mean that the coder is doing only that. The coder has built a system based on some rules, based on, whatever. Then when you put in a input, the output comes. That's what Swami is saying. So it is not as if when there's a storm coming, it's not as if Swami has to decide whether the bird should fly or not, whether the tree should move or not. It's not like that. It's all built into the rules. But then this, we take it as natural, you know. A breeze blows and a leaf just goes away in the wind. We don't feel the wonder of God's doing here. We don't see the magic. We think that is natural. That's why something that happens out of the natural, we observe it and consider it as a miracle. You know, in another conversation, I don't remember where, but Swami gives the example of who, if he chooses to, can flout the traffic lights and go through the traffic. Because he is the one who has made all the rules, and he is the one who executes the rules. So if there is a need, he can definitely flout the traffic signal and go ahead. There's nobody who will tell him anything. But generally and normally, he won't flout. He himself will follow the same rules. So when we, you know, but we observe only when the rule is flouted. We observe only something that is happening out of the ordinary. And we consider that as a miraculous thing, because this is not in accordance with the rules, this happened. Yeah, only in extraordinary circumstances when the need is there, God does that. And that's why Swami says, don't look at that one exception as a miracle. Because what Swami says here is, Baba's endless work that's going on, the breeze blowing, the water current, the monsoon, the sun rising, these are all miracles. But because we have considered them as natural, we don't see anything out of the normal. We think of it as a, you know,
a seed. And every tiny seed has the potency to grow into this massive tree.
Hmm.
And we see it so often But isn't that a miracle? So I mean, say that, you know, when I wave my hand and make when Swami takes a ring and blows it and changes its form, it's basically Swami changing, you know, one set of elements which form a certain form into another set of elements, rearranging the atoms or whatever it is called. And that is happening all the while. You have a small seed from which you have the soft leaves, you have the hard bark coming out of it, you have the sweet fruits coming out of it, you have the colored flowers coming out of it, you have the... Swami says, you don't see that as a miracle because you see it happening so often. And everything, as you were explaining, the one who has created the entire system does not have to interfere in every stage. But it does not mean that he does not have the ability to interfere or does not interfere also. Right?
When you were saying about that miracle of the seed, I just felt another reason that we fail to notice miracles is because, partially, is also because of our obsession with speed. You know, even now, if I just put a seed into the pot and 10 minutes later, if there's a plant, I am going to, they just put it and... So, our obsession with speed makes us miss many miracles, which I would like to call as slow miracles. You know, it's a slow miracle to see that little seed giving coconuts and sweet water and the nice flesh of the coconut and the leaves, the bark, as you said. But because it is taking and happening over time, we miss it. We miss the miracle of evolution. We miss the miracle that's happening every day in our life because it's not happening fast enough. You know, even my aging is a miracle actually. But because it takes 60 years to happen, I don't take it as a miracle. I take it as part of life. And Swami is telling, start focusing on these and you will realize that every moment of your life is a miracle. I think even knowing that itself will enrich and enhance our lives so much more.
Right. And I think we'll move forward in that same discourse where Swami is, in that same discussion, Swami says...
I mean, Hislop asks now. Hislop asks... Yeah.
After he mentions about that Baba is responsible also for other worlds, when Swami gives this entire example of what is a miracle, then Hislop asks, considering the endless problems that Swami deals with in this world, it is strange that he is always in bliss, always happy. And Swami responds to that saying, regardless of the event, Swami is always happy, always blissful. And then Hislop asks, please excuse a question that may seem rude. Swami seems to have different moods. What does this mean? Maybe before we come to that, we'll this explanation that Swami is giving, regardless of the event, Swami is always happy, always blissful. I think the hint or the clue to that is in that. The way Swami has worded it. I don't know what exactly Swami said in Telugu, because I don't know whose words these are. Maybe it's Khalil Gibran who says, there are only events in life. It is only you who decide whether it's a mishap or it's a pleasant happening. Right? There are only events. And how true is it? Because what is a mishap for me is not a mishap for you. I mean, it's not that you will want that mishap to happen, but the pains are different. Right? The same pain that I am going through, if it is a mishap in the absolute sense, then everybody should feel the same pain. If I lose somebody who is dear, the whole world does not cry about it. It is only I who have given that event, that color, that this is a mishap. And even within the family, for whom the same relationship, like suppose we are siblings and we have lost a parent, still within us also it's not the same relationship. It's depending on how much we give weightage to that event.
You know, speaking of it more brutally, there are people whom, when they die, some people cry over them and some people may say good riddance. You know, while one is celebrating, one is sad. Swami gives a Chinnakatha where he says that in a village, there is one farmer praying for rains because he plans to sow his seeds that day. The other farmer praying for a rainless day because he wishes to conduct his daughter's wedding that day. So the rain is an event which is sorrowful for one farmer, which is joyful for the other farmer. So as you said, as Swami says, regardless of the event, Swami is always happy and always blissful. Once again, I would like to bring up my favorite analogy and example of that of a movie. You know, when we sit and watch a movie, we are entertained by the movie, irrespective of whether it's a tragedy, whether it's an action movie, whether it's a horror movie. Yeah, of course, some of us may not like horror movies, some of us may not like, we may have our preferences. Some of us may like comedies more than the action. But definitely if we consider, if we grow, if we expand in our love as we ourselves propagated at the beginning of the satsang, and when I say I, if I consider myself as whole humanity, humanity as a whole enjoys all kinds of movies, whether it's horror, tragedy, comedy, action, everything it enjoys, because it's entertainment. And if you were to ask, how can a tragic event be entertainment for you, aren't you a sadist? The reply will be, come on man, it's just fun, it's not true, it's just a movie, you know. So the difference between somebody getting entertained by a movie and somebody not getting entertained by a movie is how much they are able to live in the awareness that it is only a false image, it's not true. When a person is dying on screen, we know that nobody has actually died. When a building is being blown and, you know, it is coming down to pieces, we know that nothing is happening in reality. That is what, you know, that is what makes us enjoy a movie irrespective of whether it's tragedy, horror, comedy or anything like that. So too, when Swami says life is an illusion, the entire life is an illusion, a construct of the mind. Once you realize your true self, when you are immersed in your reality, all of this are nothing but projections of the mind on that reality. And therefore, they will be as entertaining as a movie. Be it tragedy, be it comedy, be it romance, be it horror, whatever it might be, it is nothing but entertainment. And irrespective of what is the theme of the movie, you are getting entertained. So that is what Swami says, regardless of the event, Swami is always happy, always blissful. So that is something for us also to strive to, that awareness. And Swami would often stress in his discourses, it is not ordinary awareness, it is constant, integrated awareness.
And we've spoken about this, in fact, in the satsang which we did about the Bhrigu-Vali, the basic concept on which all Vedanta stands, and all the principles with which Swami explains the idea of happiness and bliss, is that when you talk about the Anandamaya Kosha, that is the innermost core, which means it's the natural. And all the other progressive koshas which are there are only means by which this Ananda is filtered out. In fact, when you talk about the final one, which is the Annamaya Kosha or the body.
The first one.
Right.
Huh?
It is just that this bliss is coming out. Swami says it's the bliss which is coming out from within, but it gets conditioned through all of this and comes to you in a very limited form. That if it is likable, I'll be happy. If it is pleasurable to the body, I'll be happy. If it gives me a sense of satisfaction, I'll be happy. So which means you have this enormous amount of bliss and you're putting so many barricades in front of it, and the final, you know, it's like so many filters if you put finally, even if there's a torrent, what comes is only few drops. I think that is how we enjoy a bliss. And Swami is saying the moment you start removing all these likes and dislikes and pleasant and unpleasant and disaster and a lucky incident, all of those sieves when you remove, you find the deluge of bliss which is unconditional. It does not depend on anything else. And Swami is referring to that in that sense. I think since we have already run out of time, maybe answering that question of why Swami sometimes appears moody, maybe we'll not go to that. I thought this other statement which Swami made here, where when Hislop is asking, so Swami's response to that is, yes, so many rishis and so many saints and so many great people, Swami is responsible even for them. I was just reading this, I think maybe 10 years ago we had done this conversation, and on the website there is this interview of this Muslim gentleman who, from a very young age, he was saying that he was fascinated with religion and philosophy. So though he was brought up as a devout Muslim, he said that I've read Bible with equal interest, I've read so many other scriptures with equal interest. He thought to himself that I should find out how I should surrender to God. And I should learn and I should surrender to God. Right? And he was saying that he had explored so much, he had read so much, and one day he has this dream in which he sees a distant light and he's drawn towards that, almost like a bug is drawn towards, you know, a flame.
Moth.
Right? So he starts walking towards that light and he finds that it's actually a place of worship. And much later when he saw the three domes of the museum, he realized that it says, I go into this place of worship and when I observe closely, I see sculptures of all religions. I see designs and symbols from all religions. And then when he goes there, he says, he sees two sets of people. One set sitting in the lotus posture, and the other set sitting with their knee on their knees. And again, he sees that as a symbol of, you know, people of different faiths worshipping. And then he sees that all of them are focusing on one individual who's sitting on a pedestal. And he looks at that person and he says, I could not recognize who he is. But the description he gives is very interesting. It is partially of Shirdi Baba and it's partially of Swami. He says, I see a person with that head cloth, kafni, right, what Shirdi Baba used to wear. He says he sees that head band or that cloth being worn on the head.
Oh, I don't think it's kafni. I don't know. Yeah, the head
is what Shirdi Baba used to wear, right? Yeah, so he sees that cloth tied around the head, but he also sees the curly hair under that cloth. Right, and he sees the person as being very tall, but the features he describes is that of Swami. And then he goes close to Swami and he also bows down in front of Swami. And the only thing that he hears in that dream, that person uttering, is he says, continue to strive, or something like that in that sense. That what you're trying to do is right, explode further or something. So he says that much later when he came to Swami, I think 10 years later he comes to Swami. And when Swami stands in front of him and he looks into Swami's eye, then he recognizes it's the same eye that I had seen in that dream. So when Swami says that, you know, I am reaching out to all these rishis and saints who require that dream was nothing but Swami appearing to him and saying that what you're doing is right, continue to explore, continue to aspire and continue to explore in this one. So how many saints and how many realms and how many rishis are being inspired by Swami, it's endless. So Swami saying that I'm sitting here, I'm spending this time with you, but at the same time I've not given up those duties of omnipresence that I've always had before this avatar and even after this avatar.
So on that note, dear listeners, we will bring this satsang to a close. We hope that you enjoyed and you were enlightened by this, just as we were enjoying and getting enlightened by the conversation happening between Hislop and Swami. So we will continue with the same conversation the next week as well, and for many weeks after that. Until then, enjoy this song, on the other side of which you will be greeted by Brother Chandu with his segment, Love to Love.
Listening to Radio Sai Thursday Live. Stay tuned.